Night fell over us, and we rode on doggedly through the darkness, with only the stars to light our way. With the rise of the sun, I saw that the sky and the sea were still devoid of all life. The silence and the loneliness seemed ever more ominous and oppressive. The only sounds seemed to be the creaking of the oars in the rowlocks, thrusting us onwards towards Crete. The whisper of the water along our hull, and the boom of the drum tolling the beat. None of the men spoke or laughed. Even my yellow canary had fallen silent, and just before noon he slipped off my shoulder and flopped to the deck. He was dead when I picked him up. I took him to the stern and committed his tiny body to the care of Artemis, the goddess of the birds. I dropped him into the ship's wake. Then I climbed to my station at the masthead. I scanned the horizon eagerly, but it was empty, and my disappointment was difficult to bear. I sat in my perch for an hour, and then another, watching and hoping. The merciless sunlight hurt my eyes, and after a while I began to see things that did not exist, phantom ships and illusory islands. I closed my eyes to rest them. When I opened them again, I was astonished to find that my hallucinations had intensified. The watery horizon ahead of our little ship was rising up towards the sky like a range of mountains, solid rather than liquid. Every moment these mighty oceanic Alps grew taller and more menacing. Now they were capped with glistening foam, white as freshly fallen snow. Then I heard the babble of voices coming up from the deck below. I glanced down and saw that Zaras and Hui and the other deck officers had hurried forward into the bows of the ship. They were huddled there, pointing ahead and arguing with each other. The men on the upper deck benches had ceased rowing and were standing and peering ahead. The ship was losing way and drifting to a halt. I jumped to the backstay and slid down it to the deck. When I reached it, I ran forward, shouting to the men to take up their oars and get the ship under way once more. The officers in the bows heard my voice and turned to me. Zaras ran back to me. "What is happening? Is the world turning upside down?" He pointed over his shoulder. "The sea is rising to fill the sky." He was close to panicking. "It's a wave." With an effort, I kept my voice calm and level. "No," he shook his head vehemently. "It's too big. It is coming too fast to be a mere wave. It's a tidal wave," I spoke with certainty. "The same as the one that drowned the empire of Atlantis in antiquity." "In the name of all the sweet gods, is there naught we can do to escape it?" It was unlike Zaras to give up without a fight. So I shouted in his face, "Warn your crews, damn you! Make sure they have the spare oars at hand. When that thing hits us, we are going to take damage. It will snap off our oars. We will have to maintain steerage and hold true. If it gets us side on, it will roll us over like a log and swamp us completely. Get all the hatches battened down, ship the mast and lash them down, rig lifelines along all the rowing benches, or else the crew will be washed overboard." Zaras responded at once to my peremptory orders and shouted for Hui to join him. I did not interfere any further. I left them to it and stood in the bows and watched the wave coming. The closer it came, the higher it climbed, and the faster it seemed to race towards us. We barely had sufficient time to prepare to receive it before the front slope of the wave caught us. It lifted our bows so swiftly that my knees buckled under me and my stomach pressed up against my lungs, forcing me to gasp for breath. Up and up we climbed, our stern dropped and the deck slanted away at such a steep angle that I had to cling to the bulwarks with both hands. The loose gear rolled and clattered down into the stern sheets. Despite the pandemonium, we and Zaras kept us head-on to the wave with brisk commands to the men on the rowing benches. "Heave port!" and "Avast, heaving starboard!" The men shouted entreaties to their gods and their mothers to save them, but they kept on rowing. The higher we climbed, the steeper was the slope, until our deck was almost vertical and our bows were pointing to the skies. For a brief instant, I was able to look ahead over the crest of the mighty wave. We were so high that I could see clearly on the distant horizon the southern shore of Crete, and above it the tower of smoke billowing up from the vented peak of Mount Cronus on the far side of the island. The sulphur-yellow clouds rolled up upon each other, filling the entire northern sky to the very heavens. Then the creaming crest of the wave curled over us and buried the outrageous deck under a fathom of green water. One of the lifelines snapped under the strain, and four of our crew members were swept over the side with it. We never saw them again. The rest of us were smothered by the racing water, like rats trapped in an overflowing sewer. The coarse hemp lifeline around my waist was cutting me in half. I was not even able to scream to alleviate my terror. My vision began to black out. I knew that I was drowning. Then suddenly our bows burst out through the black slope of the tidal wave. I was able to snatch a breath of sweet, clean air before we dropped into the void. We fell free for what seemed an eternity. Only the lifelines saved the rest of us from being hurled overboard with all the other loose gear. Then at last we struck the surface of the sea again with a crash and a shock that threatened to shatter every plank, bulkhead, and strake in our hull. Our oars were sheared off at the rowlocks like dry twigs. I thought we would be driven deep under again, but our gallant little ship shook herself free. We bobbed on the surface, listing heavily, our decks awash. Men and equipment were heaped upon the deck and piled upon each other. Zaras and Hui raged over them, cursing and kicking them back to their places on the benches. However, some of the crew were gravely injured with broken limbs and crushed rib cages. These were dragged to one side. The spare oars were strapped to the deck beneath the benches. The rowers heaved the shattered stumps of their oars overboard and lifted the new oars into the rowlocks. Then we all fell to bailing like men possessed. Slowly, the outrage rose high and light in the water once more. The drummer picked up the beat. The rowers stumbled back to their seats on the benches, and the blades of the oars bit and sliced through the surface. We sped forward towards Crete. From this low angle, it had disappeared below the horizon once more, but now I had the volcano smoke from Mount Cronus to guide me. A little after noon, the wind picked up and blew half a gale out of the south. The crew raised and re-stepped the masts and hoisted all our canvas to the following wind. Our speed was almost doubled. The water left behind the tidal wave was choppy and turbulent. Strewn with the debris of trees and wreckage of ships and buildings that had been ripped from the island ahead of us. But we barged our way through it with a team of men in the bows to fend off the more dangerous flotsam. Within another 2 hours, we raised the silhouette of Crete from the sea once more. It was tiny and insignificant in comparison to the heaven-high column of volcanic smoke that stood above it. Now the rumbling and bellowing of the mad god Cronus swept over us. The uproar was barely muted by the distance, and the surface of the sea itself danced to the fury of the god. The oarsmen looked back over their shoulders in awe and trepidation as they pulled towards it. The off-duty crews huddled on the deck with the wounded and the dying. All of them were white-faced with terror, but I drove them on remorselessly towards Crete. When they seemed on the verge of mutiny, Zaras and Hui unfurled the slave whips and stood over them, ready to use them. As we drew closer to the land, I was awed by the damage that the tidal wave had left in its wake. When we came in sight of the port of Crimad, I could barely recognize it. I identified it only by reference to the peak of Mount Ida that stood up behind it. All the buildings had been carried away by the wave, and even the heavy slabs of the breakwater had been tumbled into the sea like the building blocks of a petulant child. The forest and cultivated land along the foot of the mountain had been stripped bare. Great trees, the ruins of buildings, and the hulls of once mighty ships were mangled together into a mass of rubble. What perturbed me the most was that the stables were gone. The grooms and horses must have been swallowed up by the wave and washed out to sea. My princesses were on the far side of the island. Without horses, it would take days to reach them through the tangled remains of the forest. I considered trying to circumnavigate the island, but I abandoned the idea. In these perilous conditions, it would take many days, and there was no way to tell what we might find if we did succeed in reaching Knossos. All I could hope for was that a few of the relay stations that I had laid out across the spine of the island were high enough to have escaped the full fury of the tidal wave, and perhaps some of the horses had survived. We anchored on the edge of the deep water, 2 cables' length off the ruins of Crimad, where the ship was protected by the bulk of the island. Then I called Zaras and Hui to me and told them, each of the relay stations across the mountain has between 10 and 20 horses in their stables, if they have survived. With one rider up and 2 men hanging on the stirrup leathers, each animal can carry 3 men. Pick 30 of your very best men to come ashore with us. They must carry weapons only, no armor to overburden our mounts. When the shore party was ready, we launched those skiffs which had survived the ravages of the great wave. When we took to the water in these tiny craft, they were dangerously overloaded. I prayed silently to Inanna as the waves battered us and the water came sloshing in over the bows. I reminded the goddess that I was simply following her dictates, and she must have been listening. We reached the ruin of the breakwater with only 3 men swept overboard, and even one of these managed to swim back to the outrage. The skiffs were pounded to splinters almost as soon as we touched the rocks. However, we were able to scramble onto the remains of the breakwater with linked arms to support each other. We reached firm ground without suffering further loss. Then Zaras formed the men up into double file, and I led them through the remains of the drowned town. It was deserted, except for a few swollen corpses half buried in the rubble. Then we climbed the lower slope to the mountain, which had also been inundated. I was searching for the beginning of the road leading to the first relay station. All trace of it had been obliterated. We might never have found it, had we not been guided by the bugling of a hunting horn in the forest above us. 3 men of the relay team had watched our arrival from the heights and had come down the path to meet us. They were terrified, but they had convinced themselves that we had come ashore to rescue them. Their disappointment was pathetic when they realized that was not the case. I led my men up to the relay station at a jog trot that defied the steep gradient. The ground under our feet trembled and shuddered, or rocked and bounced like a small boat in a riptide, as the temper of the mad god Cronus flared or fell unpredictably. When we reached the first relay station, we found there a total of 6 men and 20 horses who had survived the devastation. The horses were almost mad with terror as the earth shook under them and the stink of burning brimstone from the mountain across the bay stung their nostrils. It took all my skills to quieten them sufficiently to be able to saddle them. We tarried there just long enough to check our weapons. I was relieved to find that my recurved bow was still dry in its waxed leather case. I was not so satisfied by the state of my spare bowstrings. I appropriated a wallet of fine, dry bowstrings from the captain of the relay station, much to his chagrin. But I held his eyes steadily as he began to protest, and he stammered into silence. Then I ordered him and all his men to remain at the relay station to cover our rear when we were forced to retreat. I wasted not another minute, but shouted at Zaras and Hui to mount up, and I led our little convoy up towards where the pathway crossed the shoulder of Mount Ida. We had almost reached the crest when there was the thunder of hooves and the snorting and bellowing of a herd of wild beasts coming down the track towards us. I was just in time to lead my men into a dense stand of trees beside the path before a mass of monstrous bodies swept down the pathway towards us. Of course, I recognized them immediately. They were a herd of wild Auroch's cattle. They pounded past us with glaring, bloodshot eyes. Their backs were humped, their hides were uniformly brindled black and dark brown. Their tongues lolled from the gaping mouths, and the frothy saliva splattered their heaving shoulders. They were driven on by panic and terror, thundering along the pathway that skirted the sheer cliff. As we watched, another tremor shook the mountain under us. I saw a deep cleft open in the rim of the cliff, full in the track of the Auroch's herd. The mountain slope was so steep and the momentum of the herd so irresistible that they were unable to avoid the drop. The entire herd poured over the cliff, the animals behind forcing those in front onwards, until every one of them plunged into the void. We heard the massive bodies striking the rocks hundreds of feet below. Afterwards, there was silence, until that also was shattered by the next roar of the volcano. I led my band back onto the pathway, and we climbed the last steep slope to the crest. Here we paused again. I looked back to where the tiny shape of the outrage was anchored off the ruins of Crimad. Then I turned in the saddle and looked ahead at the ruins of what had once been the city of Knossos, capital of the mightiest empire on earth. The great harbour was no more. There was no sign of the lighthouse. It must have been thrown down into the harbour basin. The harbour walls had been carried away, not leaving even their foundations. The wild seas dashed unhindered over the bare rocks on which the great city had stood. The supreme Minos' vaunted fleet of 10,000 ships had been hurled up above the tideline and smashed into kindling and splinters. There was no trace of a single floating hull in the whole wide bay. But the waters were thick with floating wreckage and tumultuous with the waves that still hurled themselves against the shore. The palace in which the supreme Minos had married my princesses was gone, as was also the Admiralty building and every other stone-built edifice which had lined the waterfront. Beyond this chaos, the twin volcanoes thundered and blew out flame and smoke to fill the heavens. In disbelief, I let my gaze travel over the devastation. The Minoan Empire was no more. It had been obliterated by its own crazed god. Where are my girls? My heart sobbed more clearly within me than my voice could ever have done. Why did you send me here, Inanna? Was it simply to mock and torment me? As by a force outside myself, I felt my eyes directed to the foot of the mountain directly below me where I sat my horse. I saw that the Egyptian embassy, which had been my home, albeit for so short a period, was still whole and intact. The tidal wave had not reached up that high. It was the only building on the north slope of the island that had survived. "Come on!" I shouted at Zaras and Hui. "Follow me!" And I raked my horse's ribs with the spurs. As we started down the hillside, through the forest, another shock wave from the twin peaks of Mount Cronus swept over us. My stallion shied wildly under me. I fought to control him, and although the men hanging on my stirrup leathers were thrown about dangerously, they both retained their grip until I had the horse quietened down again, and we plunged on, downwards. The embassy seemed completely deserted as I galloped up to the front entrance and jumped from the saddle. "Zaras and Hui, go round to the stable yard in the rear and see if any of the horses are still there. We will need more mounts to take us back to Krimad when we find the girls." I was determined not to surrender to despair. Inanna would not have summoned me if my princesses were no longer alive. The doors to the embassy were standing wide open. I ran through the building, shouting for any survivors. But the echoes mocked me. Every room was deserted, but most of them had been looted. The contents had been thrown about with wild abandon. My servants, or the refugees from the city, had helped themselves as they fled. I was uncertain which way to turn next. I felt the first gnawing of despair in my guts. I steeled myself against it and called aloud to the goddess for help. "Inanna, where are they? Do not desert me now. Lead me to them, I implore you." She answered me immediately, her voice echoing down from the upper level of the building. "Taita, is that you, my lord?" I heard the patter of her footsteps on the stairway. "I thought at first it was another gang of robbers seeking plunder," she cried. In her hooded gown, she raced down the last few steps and threw herself into my arms. I cupped her face in my hands and lifted it. I stared at her for a moment before I found my voice. "Loxias," I cried, "what are you doing here, child? I mistook you for somebody else. My lord Toran sent me to wait for you here. We knew that you would come. I am to show you the way to the higher temple of the god Cronus, in the mountains." She was blubbering so uncontrollably that I had difficulty understanding what she was saying. I hugged her close to quieten her. "Slow down, my little one. I do not understand any of this. Take a breath and speak slowly. At the bidding of the Supreme Minos, the priests have taken Tehuti and Bekatha to the higher temple. There they will sacrifice them to placate the god Cronus and to prevent him destroying the Minoan Empire with fire and brimstone." She drew another breath and carried on. "They have already sacrificed 40 of the virgin wives of the Supreme Minos, but Cronos had rejected them. His rage is unassuaged. He demands the ultimate sacrifice, the virgin princesses of the Pharaonic House of Egypt." "Where is Toran now?"
"He has gone to the higher temple to try to deter the Supreme Minos from this terrible deed, or, at the very least, to delay the sacrifice until you arrive. He says that you are the only one who may be able to save Tehuti and Bekatha. Somehow he knew you would come. There was a hooded lady in his dreams who warned him."
"Do you know the way to this temple?" I interrupted her.
"Yes," she said. "It is not too far from here. Toran has told me how to find the secret entrance and to work my way through the labyrinth."
I seized her arm and ran with her through the deserted rooms to the front entrance of the embassy. Zaras and Hui were waiting for me there with all their men. Zaras jumped down from the saddle and ran to meet me. "You found—" Zaras started, but then he recognized Loxias under the hood. "Where are the princesses?"
"Enough,"
I cut off his questions. "I will explain all of it to you while we ride. Loxias knows where to find them. She will take us there." We had found 6 additional horses in the embassy stables, enough for every one of the men to ride. I seated Loxias on the saddle behind me, and she locked her arms around my waist while I whipped up my stallion. We rode in a tight group. Loxias directed me to the road that ran westwards along the mountainous spine of the island. Within 2 leagues, we reached a fork in the road. The main branch continued straight on, but a lesser track branched off towards the peak of Mount Ida. This route was marked by a monstrous cedarwood tree, its dead top branches soared upwards towards the backdrop of the billowing volcanic clouds.
"Lord Toran says that this tree is 1,000 years old," Loxia spoke over my shoulder, "and this is the symbol of the god Cronus." She pointed to the skull of an enormous aurochs bull that was nailed to the trunk of cedar wood. The horns were almost twice the size of those of the bull which had killed Waga, the slave. Time and sunlight had bleached them to a dazzling white. I spent not another moment in contemplating them, but turned our mount onto the track as Loxias directed me. It climbed up through the dense forest, and it was only just wide enough to allow two horses to gallop abreast. It ended abruptly against a high blackstone cliff. Into the foot of this cliff was set a massive brass door. In the center of this door was a locking wheel of the same metal. Loxias threw herself out of the saddle behind me and landed cat-like on her feet. She ran to the doorway and began to turn the locking wheel, spinning it left and right, counting the revolutions aloud. Behind her, I dismounted and strung my bow, using one of the new dry bowstrings. Then I drew a pair of arrows from my quiver and tucked them into my belt where I could reach them in an instant. I knocked a third arrow and held the stock of my bow in my left hand. Then, with my right hand, I eased my sword in its scabbard. Zaras and Hui and all their men followed my example, readying their weapons and moving up behind Loxias and me. Loxias turned the locking wheel one last revolution, and the mechanism clicked loudly. I motioned to Zaras to help her heave on the wheel. At the same time, I stepped to one side and drew my arrow to full stretch, aiming over Zaras' shoulder. The door swung open ponderously. Close behind it stood two of the green-uniformed viragos from the Royal Seraglio. Both of them held drawn swords at the ready. They rushed forward to strike at Zaras and Loxias. Zaras was ready for them and killed one with a straight thrust into her naked, boyish chest. I killed the other with an arrow. At such close range, the arrow whipped through her torso and shattered her spinal column as it came out between her shoulder blades. It struck bright sparks from the flint wall of the tunnel behind her. Both the female warriors went down without uttering a sound. We stepped over the corpses. Shoulder to shoulder, Zaras and I raced down the tunnel. It was dimly lit by the smoking torches set in brackets on the side walls. "Torren says to take every turning to the left, or else we will be lost in the maze." Loxias was close behind me, and she called over my shoulder. I took three left turns in succession. Then I heard, very faintly, the sound of chanting, echoing down the tunnel from ahead. It grew louder as we ran towards it. I made one more turn to the left, and suddenly I saw a glimmer of daylight ahead of us. I cautioned Loxias and the rest of my men to remain where they were. Then I moved forward with Zaras and Hui, close on either side of me. The light grew brighter, and then we turned one last corner. There were two more viragos blocking the tunnel ahead of us, but both of them had their backs turned to us. All their attention was focused ahead, and they were unaware of our presence. We crept up behind them, Zaras and Hui, locked hands over their mouths to prevent them crying out, and then there was a quick flash of blades before both the women warriors sagged to the floor. We stepped over their bodies and found ourselves in a viewing balcony which had been hewn out of the living rock. 20 cubits or more below us gaped an enormous cavern, which was lit by daylight streaming through a pillared entrance in the facing wall. Through these portals we had another sweeping vista over the ruins of Knossos City and the wide bay to the peaks of Mount Cronus, which filled the horizon. Directly below us was a spacious semicircular arena. The floor was covered with fine white sand, on which stood an altar fashioned in silver and gold. On the altar stood the golden statue of an aurochs bull that was wreathed with flowers and surrounded with smouldering pots of frankincense. The arena and the altar were surrounded by tiers of stone benches. The two lower tiers were filled with rows of black-costumed and high-hatted Minoan nobles. Their faces were powdered with white chalk, and their eyes were lined with black coal in the traditional fashion. All of them were motionless, staring down intently at the empty floor of the arena. Only their mouths moved as they chanted a mournful dirge. I was astonished by how few of them there were. There had been several thousand in the harbour palace when Tehuti and Bekethe were wedded to the Minos. Gathered here today were fewer than 50. The eruption and tidal wave must have taken a dire toll of the flower of Minoan society. Behind these scant survivors rose another tier of seats, which were unoccupied. In the centre of this tier was a tall golden throne. This also was empty. Directly behind the throne was the entrance to this subterranean temple. There was a cavernous opening which framed the distant prospect of Mount Kronos across the turbid waters of Knossos Bay. The twin volcanoes belched smoke columns which mounted to the skies and almost obliterated the sun, muting it to a dull yellow orb. The balcony in which we crouched was so high above the floor of the arena that we were well above the eyeline of the audience facing us. We were also partially hidden behind long, dark-coloured curtains, which hung from the roof of the cave to just above the sandy floor. Nevertheless, I cautioned Zaras and Hui in a whisper to draw back into the shadows and sheath their swords to prevent reflections of even this diffuse daylight betraying our presence in the temple. No sooner had I spoken, when two lines of priests, dressed in their bulls' blood-red robes, filed in from each side of the amphitheatre. They took up their positions around the golden throne, and their voices joined those of the nobles to fill the temple with mournful lamentation. Then, abruptly, all sound was cut off, and the heavy silence was more oppressive than the singing. The congregation groaned, and as one they sank to their knees and pressed their foreheads to the marble tiles. I was anticipating the appearance of the Supreme Minos, watching the empty throne with all my attention, expecting another theatrical stratagem. Yet even I was taken by complete surprise. One moment the throne was empty, and the next the Minoan monarch was seated upon it with the frail and skeletal form of his mother at his side. She was clad in her widow's weeds, dark and unwholesome. He was resplendent in full regalia, towering over all his subjects, seeming to fill the cavern with his presence. His armour and his hideous bull mask of precious metals shot slivers of brilliant light into the shadows. Martial music from a hidden orchestra filled the cavern with tumultuous sound, and the congregation cried out in a transport of idolatrous ecstasy. The Supreme Minos raised his mailed right fist, and the silence that gripped the cavern was complete, almost stifling in its intensity. Even the three of us in the balcony, high above the arena, were intimidated by it. The Minos made another gesture, and the congregation gave voice again. But this was a feral sound, filled with primitive rage. Then the curtains that hung from the roof of the cavern were drawn aside to reveal two barred doorways in the rock wall, one on each side of the amphitheatre. The voice of the congregation rose in a frenzy of anticipation. Even the red-robed priesthood joined in the clamour. But now there was a further element to it. The sound was no longer that of prayer and worship. It became a bellow of salacious arousal, of carnal lust and sadistic rapture. Through the opening between the curtains marched a phalanx of green-clad viragos. They wore tall headgear dressed with the brilliant plumage of the flamingo bird. Their raised shields were made from the cured skin of the crocodile, and they overlapped to conceal something in the centre of their formation. They reached the centre of the arena and halted. Then, at some prearranged signal, their ranks opened to reveal my princesses, Tehuti and Pekatha stood holding hands and looking up at the screaming throng on the tiers above them in utter bewilderment. On their heads they wore wreaths of white roses. But that was their entire raiment. Their bodies were entirely naked. They seemed very young, tender, and almost childlike. The viragos turned in unison and marched from the arena, leaving Tehuti and Bekatha standing alone. The thunder of the congregation swept over my two darlings, and they trembled before it. The Supreme Minos rose to his feet, and the uproar subsided into silence once more. He turned slowly, so his golden mask faced the opening in the rear wall of the temple, in which was framed the distant image of Mount Cronus, and his voice soared as he began an invocation to his god. I could not make out a single word of the bellows and animal howling which reverberated from within his helmet. However, the sense of it was unmistakable, even more so when he drew from the bejeweled scabbard on his belt a massive bronze blade. It was as long as I am tall. He turned towards the two naked children on the sacrificial floor below where he stood. Now, for the first time, I discerned the actual words he uttered, although even they were blurred by the mask that covered his head and garbled by the echoes thrown back from the walls of the rock. "Dearly beloved Cronus, Cronus the first of all the gods, I am your son, the fruit of your loins, the flesh of your flesh, and the blood of your blood. For 1,000 years I have worshipped you, for 1,000 years I have loved and obeyed you. Once again I stand before you to renew my vows. I bring you the sacrifice for which your divine soul craves. I bring you royal virgin blood to drink. I bring you royal virgin flesh to devour. Come forth in your earthly guise and partake of the feast I lay before you. Kill! Eat!" He lifted the sword and stabbed it towards the barred gateway that faced Tehuti and Bekatha. The double gates swung open, but the interior beyond was in darkness. I stared into it, but at first I could see nothing beyond the doorposts. Then something moved within. Something so enormous and menacing that it defied my imagination. Bekatha wailed and shrank against her elder sister, her face bleaching with terror. Tehuti placed her arm around her protectively. Bekatha clung to her with both arms. Both of them shrank back from the gateway. A dense and palpable silence fell over the arena and the entire world beyond. The rumbling thunder of the volcanoes was cut off abruptly. The earth beneath us was stilled. It seemed that even the great god Cronus was spellbound by the drama being played out in his own temple. The silence was broken by the angry bovine snorts and the thud of great hooves on the sand-strewn paving. An aurochs bull charged through the gateway into the arena. He came to an abrupt halt as the sudden roar of the congregation struck him, and his front hooves ploughed into the sand and sent up a cloud of dust. Whereas every other aurochs I had ever seen was brindled black and dark brown, this bull was as gleaming white as the spume on the crest of the tidal wave which had destroyed the city of Knossos. His eyes were as bright as polished rubies. His body seemed to swell even larger with rage as he swung his massive head from side to side, seeking a focus for his rage. His colossal rack of horn was ivory white. The tips were glistening black and sharp as spearheads. Their spread was twice the span of a man's outspread arms. Then the creature fixed his gaze on the two naked children standing before it, and it lowered its head. The great hump between his shoulder blades seemed to swell even larger with anger, and it pawed the ground. I realized suddenly from its color and its size, as well as from the aura of evil that exuded from it, that this was no creature of forest and mountain, but something that had been sent from the fiery depths of the volcano to accept the sacrifice on behalf of its demonic master. It snarled at its prey. Its upper lip curled back to expose long canine fangs, the teeth of a carnivore, not those of an herbivore. "I bring you royal virgin blood to drink. I bring you royal virgin flesh to devour," the supreme Minos had urged this creature. "Kill! Eat!" I shook off the horror which threatened to paralyze me. "Zaras! We!" I lifted my voice above the deafening clamor of the Minoan congregation. "We have to get down there to protect them. Use the curtains, but get down there!" The two of them barged past me, almost knocking me off my feet in their haste. One after the other, they dived over the railing of our balcony, and they used the hanging curtains as they dropped. They used them to break their fall as they slithered down to the floor of the arena. But I saw they were going to be too late to save Tehuti. The gleaming white bull had focused all its attention on Tehuti, and now it launched into its charge, thundering straight at her. Beketha screamed. It was a sound that must surely inflame the monster's temper. Zaras and Hui had only just reached the floor, and they still had half the ring to cross before they could intervene. I drew and shot an arrow. It hit the bull's massive shoulder exactly where I had aimed, but I saw that it had struck bone and been deflected. It whined away and struck one of the noble Minoans in the audience. He dropped out of sight. The bull was no more than scratched by my arrow. I dared not shoot again, because Beketha had broken away from her sister. In blind panic, she ran directly into the line of the charging bull. The bull swerved towards her and dropped its monstrous head. It hooked one of the long, gleaming horns at her, and the point caught her in the upper arm. I saw her bone break and blood fly as she was thrown high over the bull's neck. She hit the ground, and I think the soft sand broke her fall. The bull turned to follow her. Tehuti reacted more swiftly than any of us. She raced forward to intercept the bull's charge, screaming shrilly and waving her arms to divert its attention. She ran under its flaring nostrils, from which the steam of its hot and stinking breath spurted in the damp air of the cavern. As she passed, she snatched the tiara of roses from her own head and dashed it into the face of the beast. Taken aback, the great bull checked slightly, giving Tehuti just enough leeway to spin around and race towards where she saw Zaras, only halfway down the curtains to the arena floor. "Zaras!" she screamed. The bull hesitated for only an instant before it turned away from where Beketha lay and came in pursuit of Tehuti. She was as quick as a gazelle, but the bull was faster. It was almost on top of her when she jinked and changed direction, gaining herself a yard before the bull could follow her around. I saw she would now pass almost directly beneath where I stood against the rail of the balcony. I drew the sword from the scabbard in my belt, lifted it high, and hurled it down into the arena. It struck point first and pegged into the sand with its hilt standing upright in front of her. "Get the sword!" I yelled down to Tehuti. Once more, Tehuti reacted with the speed and strength of a natural athlete. She swerved in her run, and as she passed the sword, she plucked it from the sand and settled the hilt in her right hand. The bull was almost on her again. It swung its head, and the point of its left horn hissed through the air as it sliced past her shoulder. Tehuti ducked under it and doubled back on the beast, sucking in her belly as the bull brushed past her. Then, as the bull tossed up its head to recover its balance, Tehuti seized hold of its nearest horn with her free hand just behind the point. When the aurochs lifted her on the horn, she did not resist. Instead, she went with him, jumping in the same direction. She sailed high over the aurochs' humped back, and as she dropped, she straightened her sword arm and aimed the point of the weapon down into its withers. Here there was no bone to turn the point. With all her weight behind it, Tahuti drove the full length of the blade down between its shoulder blades, transfixing the creature's heart. She released her grip on the hilt and left the blade in the wound. Then she arched her back as she dropped lightly to her feet behind the stricken bull and pirouetted away, with both arms held high above her own head. She stood poised and watched the monstrous animal pull up short. It spread its front hooves wide apart and lowered its head until its muzzle almost touched the sand. It opened its mouth wide and bellowed. From its throat shot a torrent of bright blood. Then it staggered backwards until its back legs collapsed under it, and it hit the floor of the arena with a sound like the fall of an axed cedar tree. It rolled onto its side. Its back legs kicked spasmodically, and then, at last, it lay quiescent. The silence in the cavern persisted as long as it took me to fill my lungs with air. Then the great god Cronus in the volcano across the bay gave full rein to his rage. He had been denied his sacrifice. The creature that was his alter ego had been slain in the precincts of his own temple. I raised my head from the spectacle in the temple arena, and I gazed out across the Bay of Knossos, and I beheld a wondrous sight. In the extremity of rage, Cronos destroyed his own stronghold. It seemed to happen very slowly. The entire mountain exploded into 1,000 massive chunks of rock, some of them as large as Crete itself, and some much larger. They were hurled aloft by the catastrophic forces that were released from the very center of the volcano that lay thousands of feet below the surface of the sea. The rock had been heated in this deep furnace until it melted and burned with a brilliant white light that seemed to dim the sun and illuminate our entire world. When the rock fell back below the surface, the sea boiled. The steam from the boiling waters exploded into spinning white clouds that climbed skywards again, obliterating everything. It was all gone, sea and earth and sky. Only the dense wall of steam remained. All this seemed to happen in silence, while the world and every living creature in it held its breath. Then came the noise of the cataclysm. It had taken that long to cross the waters of the bay. The sound smashed into the island of Crete like a solid object, something almost as substantial as the falling rock itself. Even though we were partially shielded by the walls of the cavern that surrounded us, we were hurled to the ground by the ferocity and volume of the sound. We lay whimpering and clutching our own deafened ears. The sound and the quaking of the earth prized great slabs off the roof of the cabin above us. All around me, men were crushed, screaming and sobbing to death, by the falling rock, and the floor leapt and swayed under us like the deck of a ship in a hurricane. I was amongst the first to gather my senses, but my eyes were still dazzled by the light of the burning mountain, and my hearing was dulled by the thunderous sound. I rolled onto my knees and gazed around the cavern. I was not the only person stirring. Zaras had crawled to where Tahuti lay behind the carcass of the bull. He was cradling her in his arms. I could see she also was dazed and bewildered. Hui was kneeling over Bekatha. He seemed afraid to touch her. This was a warrior who had bestridden many a battlefield, but he was terrified by the blood of the woman he loved. She was cradling her broken arm and looking up at Hui like a child seeking comfort from a beloved parent. I looked beyond them and saw the Supreme Minos. He was standing in the opening of the cavern, facing the clouds of steam which obliterated the place where Mount Cronos had once stood. The Minos was holding the frail body of his mother in both hands, high above his head. I saw that her skull was crushed, and her eyes were bulging out of their sockets. She had been struck and killed by the rocks falling from the roof of the cave. "Why have you done this to us? I am your own son, mighty Cronus," the Minos bellowed. "My mother was your lover and your wife. Could you not have accepted the sacrifice I offered you and spared her?" I knew that I had to kill him before he was able to let loose more evil upon our world. This time I knew he would destroy us all. My princesses, my friends and companions, and me. I threw up my bow and shot the arrow across the cavern. It struck the Minos in the center of his golden backplate. It transfixed his body, and black blood sprayed from the hole that my arrow had ripped in his armor. The stench of it filled the temple like that of rotting corpses that had lain 10 days in the sun. The force of my striking arrow hurled the Minos bodily through the opening in the cavern wall. He fell from my sight. His mother's corpse lay where he had dropped it, like a pile of old black rags. I jumped over the balcony wall and slid down the curtains to the floor of the arena. Then, as I ran to where Becatha lay, I unhooked the sword scabbard from my belt. I knelt beside her and told Hui, "Hold her firmly. This will hurt her." She whimpered as I straightened the broken bones in her arm and used the sword sheath as a splint to fix them so. Then I took the wine flask from the pouch on my hip and handed it to Hui. "Give her as much as she asks for," I told him, "but it's a fine Cyclades and much too good for a ruffian like you." Becatha smiled through her pain and whispered, "Hui is my man. From now onwards, wherever he goes, I go. His home is my home, and the wine I drink is his to share with me." I was proud of her. I looked around the temple and saw that the Virago guards from the royal Seraglio had fled. I thought that all the Minoan nobles had gone with them, but then I saw Toran standing beside Zaras and Tehuti with his arm around Loxias. "Will you come with us, my old friend?" I asked him, and Toran paused for a moment before he replied, "The Minoan Empire has perished here today. It will never rise again. This was prophesied 500 years ago." His expression was somber, but after a moment he went on speaking. "I have lost my homeland, but Egypt has lost her most powerful ally against the Hyksos Scourge." He sighed. "Nevertheless, Loxias and I will go with you to Thebes and make it our new homeland." "I'm afraid to ask you, Zaras and Tehuti," I said, as I turned to the two of them. It was no surprise to me that Tehuti spoke for both of them.
"Darling Taita, I love both you and Egypt, but I love Zaras more," she said simply. "If I return with you to Thebes, my brother will seek to marry me to another mad king in some other barbaric land. I have served my pharaoh and my country to the very limits of my duty. Now I want to be free to live the rest of my life with the man I love." She took Zara's hand. "We will go with Hui and Becatha and find another home in the northern lands, beyond the Ionian Sea."
"I wish I could go with you, but I cannot," I told her. "My duty is with Pharaoh in Thebes. I will tell him that you and Becatha are dead, so that he will never send to search for you."
"Thank you, darling Tata," she said, and then she hesitated before she spoke again. "Perhaps one day, if the gods are kind, you will come to find us again?"
"Perhaps," I agreed.
"I will name my first son after you," she promised.
And I turned away to hide the tears that filled my eyes. Then I climbed the tiers of stone benches, which now were empty. I reached the opening of the cavern wall through which my arrow had thrown the body of the Minos. I stood on the verge of the drop and looked down 300 feet to where he lay spread-eagled on the rocks below in a pool of his own congealing blood. My arrow stood out of his silver breastplate. His helmet still covered his head, I could see nothing through the dark eye-holes that seemed to stare up at me. "What were you?" I pondered the question aloud, but speaking softly. "Were you man or monster, devil or godling?" Then I shook my head. I pray never to know the answer to that question. The body of Pasiphae, the mother of the Minos, lay at my feet. I picked it up and dropped it over the cliff. When I looked down again, I saw that they lay together, with arms and legs obscenely tangled like those of lovers, rather than mother and son. I turned away and went down into the arena where my girls waited for me. All of us left the temple and went out through the labyrinth to where the horses waited in the forest. We mounted and rode together as a family for the last time. We climbed the slopes of Mount Ida, and we drew rein on the shoulder and looked back across the Bay of Knossos. Mount Kronos was gone, sucked back into the abysmal depths of the ocean once more. Only the turbid waters of the boiling sea marked its grave. Then we looked ahead to where the port of Crimad had once stood, and we saw all six ships of the flotilla had survived the tidal wave and were anchored safely offshore. They were waiting to receive us. All those around me shouted with joy and excitement, urging their horses down the path through the forest. They rode in pairs, Lord Toran with Loxias, we cradling Becatha to his chest to shield her injured arm, and Zaras with Tehuti up behind him, urging him to greater speed. I hung back and let them go. Let their separate journeys begin here and end for all of them on the hills of happiness, I whispered aloud. But my pleasure for them was tempered by my melancholia for my own self, poor, lonely Taita. Then I heard a voice that might have been only the evening wind in the treetops. You will never be alone, Taita, for a noble heart is the lodestone which draws to itself the love of others. I looked around me in wild amazement, and I thought I saw her coming down to me through the forest in her hood and cloak. But the light was fading, and I could have been mistaken. That was Desert God by Wilbur Smith, read by Mike Grady, produced by ID Audio for Harper Audio.